Lee Miller. Who was she? Model, artist, lover, explorer, photographer, cook, mother. And the subject of a recent show in San Francisco at the Palace of the Legion of Honor, Man Ray, Lee Miller, Partners in Surrealism. And she is the subject of Carolyn Burke's biography entitled Lee Miller, A Life. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is A Novel Idea. Please stay tuned for an hour of conversation, music, and inquiry. You may recall a couple of months ago we featured my conversation with Carolyn Burke, whose latest work is No Regrets, The Life of Edith Piaf. I so enjoyed my conversation with Carolyn that when one day I was driving through the city and saw banners showcasing the Lee Miller exhibit at the Legion, I knew I must meet Carolyn there and let her tell me about Lee Miller. And that's just what we did. Carolyn's interested in exploring people who interest her and who are somewhat under-discovered. Her first biography was Becoming Modern, The Life of Mina Loy, a poet and artist who paved the way into modernism but is not as well known as Gertrude Stein, Colette, or Anais Nin. Australian by birth, Carolyn Burke lives in Santa Cruz, and without further delay, let's listen to my conversation with her in one of the galleries of the Palace of the Legion of Honor in San Francisco. I began by asking her how she discovered Lee Miller.
First, I encountered her in the memoirs of expatriates in Paris in the 1920s and 30s, and in particular in the beautiful photographs of her by Man Ray. But I thought, well, she's another beautiful woman in Paris at a time of many beautiful women and muses. It wasn't until I saw her photographs many years later in the first show of them in the U.S., I think in the early 90s, that I realized that she had become a remarkable photographer in her own right. In particular, it was her photographs of the concentration camps at the end of World War II after the liberation, that struck me as unbelievably strong and so unlikely, given that she began as a model, a beauty, other people's muse, and then she became the woman who documented what took place in the concentration camps.
And in your book, which you title Lee Miller, A Life, you do bring this perspective of her from childhood onward as somebody who has a lot of complexity to her and a lot of brightness, a lot of beauty, and a lot of pain and reflection on that. Could you talk a little bit about the trajectory of Lee Miller's life?
Yes. She grew up in an eccentric and rather unconventional middle-class family in Poughkeepsie, New York, as her father's darling. For the first 7 years of her life, she enjoyed herself tremendously. She lived with the freedom of her brothers. She was a tomboy and climbed trees and rode on homemade railways and, in general, had tremendous freedom. We're talking about the early part of the 19th century because she was born in 1907. What happened? A tragic and somewhat mysteriously perplexing event, story, took place when the little girl was only 7 years old. She was raped by a friend of some family friends when she was in their care in Brooklyn, I believe. This person, the rapist, was never identified properly and never convicted. Elizabeth, as she was called at that time, her given name, suffered tremendously, more than we can even imagine, because everything was hushed up. It was scandalous for anyone to speak about rape, let alone about the treatment. The treatment itself was particularly painful, administered by her mother, who was a trained nurse. She was subjected to these series of hideously painful treatments with medications then available before our antibiotics and other modern remedies. Within a few years, she was misbehaving like crazy. She wouldn't go along with any of the rules at any of the schools she was sent to. She was kicked out of a series of them and became a thoroughgoing rebel, which she might have been anyway. But this may perhaps be seen as her way of protesting both against the rigid standards of the Poughkeepsie middle class, where she grew up, and her way of dealing with what happened to her. So that's the early story, up to the point when she gets discovered by Condé Nast and becomes a model.
And her becoming a model really was then a point of entree into a whole different world and a whole different sense of people, and it really exposed her to a lot, and she seemed to thrive on that.
Yes, she did, in part because she had already moved to Manhattan, and the life of New York in the 1920s was just what she wanted. It suited her to a T, the freedoms, first as an art student, because she began by going to the Art Students League in New York, then as a model on the cover of Vogue, no less, for her very first assignment, and from then on invited to all the most glamorous outings and parties and given gorgeous clothes to wear and having many beaux and suitors following her about, doing her every wish. That must have been a very heady time for a young woman who was only in her early 20s.
And she was also an intelligent, thoughtful person who had ideas about art and photography. And her father was a photographer, and maybe we can talk a little bit about that. That she seemed to be a muse for a lot of people, including her father, but yet she seemed to want a different role in relation to art.
Yes, the relation to the father is another aspect of her life that can never be thoroughly elucidated, but that is most intriguing and perplexing to us, given our own perspectives. She posed for her father nude from childhood on. This was not so unusual. We can think of all the bear babies on rugs that we used to see in people's photo albums, if at a more innocent time, we might say. But what took place later on in her teens, when she was already a smashingly beautiful, nubile young woman, was that he took to photographing her nude again in a variety of remarkable poses that when I first saw them caused my flesh to crawl. I jumped to conclusions a little too soon, I believe, because I learned later on in my researches that she was not his only muse. Her father would photograph every woman whom he could persuade to disrobe. And he was very good at doing that, because if you didn't take your clothes off for Theodore Miller, then you felt like a prude. So he also photographed his wife, Lee's friends, and a whole variety of other ladies, because he could claim that this kind of pose was art. If you called it art with a capital A, then it was acceptable. Be that as it may, Lee and her father were very, very close for the rest of their lives.
You know, Carolyn, the way you've approached this book, it seems like you inhabit her in a way, and there really is a colorfulness to your describing her life and even using her words at some times. So tell me a little bit about your process in writing the book and how you approached that.
I don't know if I inhabited her or if she inhabited me. In any case, I seem to live in my imagination and sometimes in my daily life in her worlds, because she passed through many for about 6 or 7 years when I was writing this book. I was so close to her life, but at the same time, I did scrupulous research to make certain that I was letting the details of her life shape my interpretation. It's a funny thing to live with someone that closely in your heart and your mind while you're also pouring through the archives. It's a process of assimilation, imagination, and becoming something of a channel, letting the person and all of this material that you're able to find and put together speak through you, if that makes sense.
It does come through in the book, in the writing, this humanizing of her in a way, and especially of her reactions to things, especially these painful episodes in her life. Now, there's so much to talk about her. I wanted to jump right into her World War II experience, but I think in some ways we need to set that up with the contrasting that to her time with Man Ray.
Ah, well, we could do it that way, yes. She went to Paris to become a photographer after having spent several years being photographed. She was very intelligent, although largely uneducated because she would not follow the rules. And she learned on the spot. She learned from the great photographers at Vogue, people like Steichen and Genthy and the others who were photographing in New York in the 20s. How you use the apparatus, how you set up the lights, principles of composition. In other words, she had a marvelous internship on the spot. But when she asked Steichen who would be the photographer he would recommend for the most contemporary approach to the art, Steichen mentioned Man Ray, an American who was already in Paris and had become quite famous in avant-garde circles for his work. So Lee, by then she had changed her name, shortened it, with the backing of her father, who was very often very generous and very helpful to her in, as she pursued new interests, went off to Paris and managed to find Man Ray, even though he was about to leave on holiday. And when she turned up and said, "I'm your new student," he said, "I don't take students." And she said, "Well, you'll take me." And he did. The stories are apocryphal, but they're quite delightful. When she made up her mind to do something, and in this case, to study with the most advanced photographer on the European scene, she was able to carry it off. So for really only a short time, about 3 years, she worked as his assistant. She did his printing. She was his muse, his subject. They were lovers. She was really central to his output. He also taught her everything that she wanted to know in the way of avant-garde technique. And together they discovered solarization, which had been known before but not called that. And as a result, their work is often hard to attribute. What they were doing is often so similar that people have been unable to say, is this a Man Ray, is this a Lee Miller, although I think I can tell. But that was a very rich period in her life as an artist, as a woman, and we could say, if we wanted to put it that way, that it completed her training as a photographer.
His influence remained with her in her subsequent photographic pursuits, but they also remained friends for their entire lives, yes?
Yes, that's one of the things that I admired, and there are many, in Lee Miller. While she had many, many lovers, and the breakups were often dramatic, although the one with Man was the worst of all, the most traumatic for him, surely, she very often managed to become friends again after a certain period of time. And the various lovers I spoke to were all very clear about this. She was a marvelous friend, even when the love phase was over. Now, with Man Ray, it took about 5 years because he was so undone by her leaving him that it took its time. But from then on, and I've been told this by others who knew them, who saw them together, in a way, they were even closer because she was the photographic, artistic, creative partner who understood him fully. So that even in their later years, when she was close to dying in her late 60s, it was early, she died at 70, he would come to visit her in England and sit and talk with her in ways that showed how remarkable a relationship this was. I like that.
When she moved beyond him in a way, she moved back to New York and had a photographic studio there and was photographing, I'll say, a lot of famous people, and it seemed to be she was part of a scene there. But I sense that maybe she needed more than that.
You're quite right. She got tired. She seemed to tire of things rather quickly. Within a couple of years, she had had enough of that life as the photographer in New York, even though she was photographing wonderfully exciting people and events like Gertrude Stein's opera Four Saints in Three Acts and other very, very notable events of the time. At the same time, there was a man, another man, who pursued her. This man is named Aziz Elouy Bey, a marvelously attractive, cultivated, upper-class Egyptian gentleman who pursued her. They had first met in France at a ski lodge, then seen each other again, had an affair in Paris, which was part of the reason for Man Ray's fury. But he managed to come to New York. And to everyone's surprise, particularly that of Lee's brother, who was her photographic assistant, she decided to close up her studio, marry Aziz, and go back to live in Cairo with him. So that after a couple of years of being on her own, earning a good living as a photographer, and being named as one of the best young photographers in the U.S., she chucked it.
She did seem to be kind of nonplussed by some of this stuff. They were her experiences, and as you say, when she felt like doing something else, she did. So tell us about how she did get involved in what some people find notable about her experience during World War II and chronicling that through photographs for Vogue, I believe, yes?
Yes, she happened to have gone to England, to London, to be with Roland Penrose, the next man in her life, whom she married after she divorced Aziz, just in time, or not, for the outbreak of World War II. They arrived the day that England declared war on Germany. So she was living in England with Penrose in the early years of the war and desperate to be able to make a contribution, as all of the artists and intellectuals were doing in whatever way they could. As an American citizen, she was not able to get the right kind of work permit until Condé Nast, her old employer, and Vogue had branches all around the world, including one in London, which was called Brogue. I love its nickname. The French one was Frogue. They decided that they could indeed employ her because this, for technicalities having to do with her status. And so she began photographing London under the Blitz. There were many remarkable subjects that caught her eye, which was sort of surrealist by nature. She went around photographing the results of the Germans' bombing, and very often these are some of the most stunning photographs that we see of hers. I admire them greatly. Well, when the Americans began to prepare for D-Day, for the invasion, in 1944, she was finally able to seek accreditation with the American Army, which allowed her to become officially sponsored, so to speak. And she did go in, not on D-Day, but with the Americans some weeks later, and from then on began to do the work that I think you're speaking of, photographing across France as the battles were still fought to root the Germans out of their strongholds, and then into Germany, and finally all the way across Germany to the camps as they were being liberated, and of course then beyond, because she kept on going even after the war into Eastern Europe. She was partly a freelance, and in that she made her own arrangements. She didn't always travel with the army at all, but she did send all of her work back to Condé Nast, and her photographs of the war and the collateral damage, and her dispatches, equally important, her remarkably well-written accounts of what she was seeing, were published in French, English, and American Vogue.
Can you contrast the work, her work, with that of Margaret Bourke White?
That's an interesting question. I did think quite a bit about it, and I even managed to compare photographs by both women of the same subjects, for example, at some of the camps where they both visited on the same day. It seemed to me that Lee Miller, to sum it up, would get closer into right up next to so that you could almost smell and touch her subjects, whereas often Bourke White held back for whatever reason, made a fine composition suitable for publication in, I think it was Life magazine at the time, but did not get as close in the very, very personal way that Lee Miller did. And that could indeed have something to do with Lee's subsequent depression. She had been too close. She had smelled too much. She had been devastated by everything that she saw at the camps. Whereas Bourke White was able to go on. Of course, there were different kinds of people. But there are some photographs that are interesting to look at side to side. And as the two most celebrated women photographers in the war, it would be well worth having a show of their photographs together.
You do suggest in the book, as you've just suggested right now, that the experience during the war, and she really was unflinching in her participation and her chronicling of it, but you suggest that maybe this, on top of some of her earlier trauma, created a real sense of almost post-traumatic stress in her life.
Yes, it was when I came upon the concept of post-traumatic stress as a possible response by rape victims to the trauma that they have experienced that it all came together in my mind. I have tried to present what happened to her after the war as a kind of post-traumatic stress response in which the old memories which had been suppressed, the sense of harm done to her as a very young child, may have in a way resurfaced when she saw the immense harm, damage, trauma done to people during the war. This connection may have been subliminal, but I think it was at issue. She never spoke about the war afterwards. She never spoke about what she saw at Dachau until much later, with a very few younger women. It's so touching that she spoke to a niece and to another young woman, and she spoke to them only late at night, or maybe 2 a.m. when they'd drunk a lot of whiskey, when she could actually return to the subject of what she saw in Dachau. So that's how it came together for me.
She then kind of settled down into an unlikely domestic life of cooking.
It did seem unlikely. It was a bit of a challenge to me to work out how this came to pass. Well, the story is that at the end of the war, she was still going on adrenaline, as we sometimes do after major devastating events. We just keep going because the adrenaline has been pumping for so long. She continued, as I said, to report from Eastern Europe as the communists were taking over in Poland and the other countries. But after a time, she was really a burnt-out case. She could not continue. She had seen too much. She had lived too hard. She had drunk too much. She decided, with the encouragement of her dear friend and partner, Davy Sherman, who often photographed with her, that she had best go back to Roland Penrose, the man she had joined in England. And in a way, I think it was probably something of a deliberate choice. Either she could go back to the U.S., which she'd lost touch with the country in a way for many years, or she could return to London and to Penrose, which is what she chose to do. Within a year or so, she became pregnant and gave birth to their son. She and Penrose married, and her life changed dramatically at age 40. She must have made a kind of a bargain that also, given her state of mind, her emotional and physical exhaustion, that this would be yet another phase of her existence. She would bring up her child with her husband, and she would live the rather pleasant life that he offered her, because he was a man of considerable means. The life that he offered included a very nice house in Hampstead, and then a much bigger house in the country, so that within a few years she found herself leading this sort of wife of the English country gentleman life. She was still photographing. She still did some reportage for Vogue, but it wasn't as interesting. It was mostly fashion. What did you do after a life of the kind she led? It would be very hard to find much that was interesting in the new look, which came in after World War II, and the return to femininity, which was being heralded in the pages of Vogue and other magazines. She did, however, turn to cooking, because there was so little that was good to eat. We have to remember that the English suffered immensely after the war. The recovery was it took a very long time, and the food was so bad that she decided she'd do what she could, having tasted good food here, there, and everywhere. And so she obtained what there was to be had in the way of good products, and she began cooking. Well, it was quite creative in its own way, as we know. Cooking can be enjoyable. She started making up her own recipes, including very wild, surrealist ones. And this fit in with Penrose's country gentleman life, because he invited his friends, associates, and colleagues, including a great many of the well-known artists in the post-war period, and even people like Pablo Picasso, their dear friend, down to the house in the country. And so Lee found herself cooking for these illustrious parties, but very often not able to produce dinner until 10 or 11 at night, because she'd had so much to drink and they'd all had so much to drink while the cooking was happening.
So she still remained plugged in with other artists.
Yes, she did. And I must say, I like the body of work from that period, because she'd bring out her camera and she'd photograph these friends, sometimes doing very amusing things. And so there's a nice little group of artists misbehaving and enjoying themselves at Farley Farm. That's the name of the Penrose home down in Surrey, when they're having these wonderful, wacky English weekends where everybody drinks too much.
So she maintained some of that surrealist sensibility. How come the general public doesn't know more about Lee Miller?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it's probably because she ceased to have outlets, consistent outlets for her photography and her writing, which got better and better. You know, she wrote wonderfully about cookery, too. She ceased to have these outlets in the early mid-50s when Roland Penrose, her husband, wrote to her editor at English Vogue and said, in confidence, "This is torture. I can't bear it. Lee really cannot go on anymore. It's taking too much out of her. We can't live with it. I want you to stop asking her for pieces. Stop giving her assignments." Well, when this marvelous editor whom I interviewed told me this, I was astonished. But I could also understand this from the perspective of the family, who did find that it was too painful to see Lee going through torture each time she had to write an article. So this is how she came to be less than well known. And it wasn't until her son, Anthony Penrose, rediscovered, or maybe I should say discovered, because apparently he never knew, that his mother was a remarkable photographer. When he came across some 40,000 negatives in the attic at Farley Farm, no one knew until that point, or they had forgotten, rather, that this had been the case. And it was thanks to his unearthing this work and making it available that we could see who she was.
You've mentioned some of your sources. Did you mine that archive, but also talk to some original sources as well?
Yes, I did. I worked extensively in the archive at Farley Farm, including her correspondence, all the photographs, many other kinds of materials. I also interviewed great numbers of people. I think when I counted, there were more than 100 in England, France, the U.S., and elsewhere. And I read extensively about the war, because at the time when I was writing the book, no one really knew her itinerary, where she'd gone when. And so I found myself studying histories of World War II so that I could work that out, because when I saw, oh, she was with this general at that place, then I could see, aha, so she went from there to there. And I never expected to be doing research on World War II, but I did that as well. And I studied the pages of Vogue, all three Vogues, as you can imagine. That was some of the best fun, working in the Vogue archives.
That was part of my conversation with Carolyn Burke, recorded in San Francisco at the Palace of the Legion of Honor. I'm Suzanne Lang. You're listening to A Novel Idea. You can listen online at krcb.org or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Please stay with us for more of Carolyn Burke. I'm Lee Miller. It's KRCB's A Novel Idea, and we are National Public Radio. Let's take a little break and listen to another maverick of the avant-garde, Laurie Anderson. Please stay with us for more of Carolyn Burke on Lee Miller.
There's a story in an ancient play about birds called The Birds. And it's a short story from before the world began. From a time when there was no earth, no land, only air and birds everywhere. But the thing was, there was no place to land, because there was no land. So they just circled around and around, because this was before the world began. And the sound was deafening. Songbirds were everywhere. Billions and billions and billions of birds. And one of these birds was a lark. And one day her father died. And this was a really big problem, because what should they do with the body? And there was no place to put the body, because there was no earth. Solution. she decided to bury her father in the back of her own head. And this was the beginning of memory. Because before this, no one could remember a thing. They were just constantly flying in circles. Constantly flying in huge circles.
I'm Suzanne Lang, and so glad you're listening. Carolyn Burke and I moved into the main exhibit of the Man Ray Lee Miller Partners in Surrealism show in San Francisco. Please indulge us as the exhibit has a soundtrack and there are lots of people around, often gathering around us as Carolyn would talk about the pictures we were looking at.
When she was discovered by Condé Nast, within a month or two, she was on the cover of Vogue. Of course, it's a drawing, but it is Lee with the look of the period, the quintessential flapper. She's about 20 or 21 at the time, with this stylized Manhattan background. She looks like an icon.
She has, and it is in this version of her almost an androgynous look there.
That's right.
But she also has a very modern look about her.
I think that was part of her appeal. Of course, she cut her hair short, but so did many other women. She had a slightly androgynous figure with a very, very beautiful classical face. And so she had a strange appeal that went beyond classically pretty. She also had a soft side. It depended on who was photographing her. This one, for instance, by Edward Steichen, the great American photographer. It's a photograph for Vogue. She's a model wearing the sun hat. But he knew how to photograph her in ways that brought out another aspect, her softness, her thoughtfulness, really. So it depended a lot on who was taking her picture. She noticed that herself. She commented at one point that she could look any number of different ways depending on who was taking the photograph. And she remembered that when she became a photographer.
What about this one, a Man Ray photograph?
Well, Man Ray took her photograph quite early. I would guess that this is a little earlier than the date, 1930, by her hair. He liked the ambiguity of her appearance and sexuality in some way that kind of fit in with the surrealist idea of the enigma of the woman. They had some very funny and somewhat provocative, not to say disturbing, ideas about the place of women in the surrealist imagination, and she seemed to fill the bill for him and for some of his cohort, because he put his photographs of her in their magazine, Surrealist Revolution, with the caption, La femme surréaliste, the surrealist woman. So from having been a Vogue model, she next became the surrealist woman, in part, I think, because of this ambiguity that you mentioned.
And she seems to enjoy the kind of inhabiting of a role, or, I mean, there's such a focus that she takes on in these photographs.
I think that from her art student days, she had a very good sense of staging, and indeed she had studied stage design in Paris as a rather young woman. So she brought to her own posing a very, very strong sense of both performativity and of staging. This is mostly Man Ray. Oh, here we could, if you want, have a little look at Jean Cocteau's film Blood of a Poet, in which Lee plays the statue muse who, wouldn't you know it, has to be destroyed by the poet in order for him to unleash his creativity. This was a very early talkie. And Cocteau, as so the story goes, found Lee Miller in a nightclub in Paris and said, I'm looking for someone to play the statue in my new movie, which was then called The Life of a Poet. Do you know anyone who would do it? And Lee volunteered. She said, I'll do it. Because she was always up to try something new. And to work with the famous poet, playwright, Jean Cocteau, was her idea of, a good time. Here we see the scene of the poet studying this statue who is all white, and he's about to keep her from talking. One could make comments about, why is it that the woman in the has to be rendered mute so that the poet can do what he wants to do. Apparently she had to be covered with plaster of Paris to act this statue part, and it was a very trying occasion, done on the cheap, but very inspiring to all involved. It made Man Ray furious that she acted in a movie for Cocteau, because they were practically enemies. The surrealist disapproved of Cocteau and thought that he was borrowing all of their ideas and that his politics were negligible. What do you think of it?
I think looking at some of these early surrealist films, you can really feel the energy and dynamism of the time.
Yes, that's true. I would agree. There was tremendous freeing of the imagination in these sorts of movies made by poets and artists and avant-gardists, and everyone was very excited about them and by them. Shall we go into the next room?
Yes.
Where there are more by me?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Lee had various approaches to photography in Paris once she was settled there with men. Sometimes she took photographs like the one we're looking at now out of her own, the window in the artist studio where she lived, which I was able to visit, so I can identify this photograph. And to my mind, quite a few of them are not only stunning for formal reasons, because there are frames within frames. She shows how the view is contained and framed by the various shapes that one is looking at and through. But I think she's also reflecting in photographs like this on her own position in this new world of the Paris art world. The ways in which she's both constrained by the window that's closed in a sense, and by the blockage of the wall opposite, and how she's also able to do as the great photographers do, like Eugène Atget and many others known for photographing Paris, make their circumstances, their surroundings into poetic and evocative subject matter. So this is kind of a Lee Miller, early Lee Miller Paris photo, where she's really working her way through the tradition, to my mind. And the one next to it, too, these angles, that's the stairway going down in that same building to the courtyard. And I think it's very interesting because of the way she uses the different diagonals to give a sense of motion, but also a strange, vibrant kind of composition that's pretty Art Deco, naturally, given its time, but also, for me, very immediate. We could be walking down the stairway, at different points in our descent, looking at this photograph. Here's another one of that series. Do you think? I mean, we wouldn't expect those from her necessarily. Very, very architectural, atmospheric, and kind of conscious of the whole tradition of photographing Paris, urban photography.
But there's also something kind of abstract and visually pleasurable about it as well, and her use of light and shadow. And I think when I look at some of these photographs and then of the work she does later on, it seems like she is definitely has an aesthetic.
We were repeatedly interrupted while perusing the exhibit, so adjourned to a quieter corner to complete our conversation. Now here's the conclusion of me and Carolyn Burke on Lee Miller.
Did you were having actually met her, and I'm assuming that was
at the end of her
at
life.
At the end of her mm-hmm. life, mm-hmm. give you, I want to say, the juice to then move forward with this in a different way?
I think so. But as I said, it wasn't until I actually saw her photographs that I could put it all together. Yes, meeting her and talking with her and the affinity that there was instantly. She invited me to come and visit her in England, to come and stay at Farley Farm. That was the beginning point. But it was seeing her war photographs that caused it to click. So there are all sorts of wonderful photographs. I'm like, these are very funny. When she was still in England, when she couldn't get accreditation.
But there in that photograph, you also see some of, I don't know, I see that sensibility of hers comes through of maybe seeing the absurdity in the mundane.
That's right. I would say that was always with her. It's wonderful the way this long white robe seems to be guarding the feminine underwear. She can see the humor and the, what should we say, the female point of view in this war work, what is technically war work. Also, she's fascinated by the idea of women using instruments of power. Machinery, guns, all the kinds of things that women took over, taking charge of when the men were sent away. And I think that interested her very much. She did a whole book on English women's war military work.
Well, it seems like you even had that take on her picking up, getting behind the camera instead of in front of it.
Yes, I think that was her way. She had a very strong mechanical aptitude. She could take apart machines and put them back together, partly having grown up like as her brothers did and being taught by their father. There was nothing that was going to hold her back, really, once she set her mind to getting behind the scenes and studying.
But these photographs are, they're at once beautiful and shocking.
Yes. And we could call that surrealist if we wanted to, but I think that that's not the only way to think about that combination of registers, which often don't go together. She saw the horrors and the dangers in moments of extremity, like these scenes from the war.
Picture of Hitler. Is that a picture?
She arranged that. We're looking at a photograph taken in Leipzig after the suicide of a family of a high Nazi official. And many war photographers came in to shoot this scene. So we can compare her work with the photographs taken by others. Lee brought her sense of staging to this picture, brought in the photograph, the picture of Hitler, and put it where it would be quite noticeable as part of the composition, as if to suggest, you know, who is the architect of this death scene? The Führer himself.
Yes. But I can't imagine how absolutely shocking. I mean, the pictures are shocking, but the reality with the dirt and the smells and the just
100 times
I mean,
worse.
It just, yeah.
And I spoke to someone about what it's like to see such things, who was herself a photographer. She said, the images are imprinted on your brain. They may be black and white as we see them, but they were in color at the time. This one I find completely remarkable. The photograph of the dead SS prison guard floating in a canal at Dachau just after the liberation. The way this prison guard in his heavy leather coat is both sinking and somehow rising, the water, the strangely intense focus of both the horrific knowledge that she brings to bear and that we bring to bear to this photo, and the strange, calm beauty of the image, how all of that can coexist.
I've often thought it takes a certain amount of courage to take pictures of dead people.
Mm, good point.
It's hard to keep a steady gaze on something.
Yes, it
like
is.
That.
Fortunately for her, not long after taking this photo, she went to a celebration with the Dutch survivors at Dachau, who invited her. It happened that the day of the liberation was also the birthday of their queen, and they were having a party with whatever they could round up to celebrate with. And I interviewed one of these men. He said that they never forgot Lee Miller. She was somehow a beacon for them, that she had come, that she was with them, that she was photographing all of this. It gave them great comfort. Then there's this one, this famous one.
That's on the back of the...
Yes, yes, Lee Miller in Hitler's bathtub that evening. That is a stunner.
Yeah. Who took that?
Her friend Davy Sherman, okay. Her partner with whom she traveled, whom we see in the photograph with the gas mask in London. Again, yes, Hitler in the background. Whenever possible, she staged the scene. And here we see Hitler presiding over her attempt to wash off the dust and dirt of Dachau in his own bathtub. He, of course, is not there. He's, except in the form of a photo, he had already escaped to his eagle's nest up in the mountains. And ironically, the American headquarters in Munich, which is so close to Dachau, was in Hitler's own house because there was still running water, electricity, communications, and all the rest. So Lee Miller and Davy Sherman were billeted there, and that is how she got to be in Hitler's bathtub that night.
She seemed to be at places that almost Zelig-like, you know.
Yes.
She's everywhere, and she's met so many interesting people.
But it's an interesting point. I've wondered about it. And I wonder, are certain people drawn to historic moments and cultural high points? How does this happen? I can say this much. She had an eye for the main chance, and she felt instinctively, intuitively, what was important, and she would go. She didn't hesitate like some of us. If she felt it was the right moment and the right situation, she would be there in a flash. So it was something in her character as well.
And I wonder if that earlier, her experience as a young child, in some ways maybe took away a lot of her fear.
Oh, that's an interesting possibility. I mean, that she could survive. She knew that she would through her strength of character and her determination. I don't know. She was a very strong woman facing her death. When I met her, we got along splendidly. And at the end of our first conversation, she turned to me and she said, "You know, I'm dying." And I said something incredibly naive or gauche, like, "Please don't, we've only just met. No, don't do that." And she said very calmly, "I'm going to deal with this. It will happen inevitably." And indeed, in a few, 3 months later, she was gone. But she said, "It's going to be the most remarkable experience of my life," mm-hmm. which gives me the chills to this mm-hmm. day that she could face this. Mm-hmm. In this way.
Without fear.
Without fear. Yeah. So you might be right.
Yes. Well, what good fortune you had to meet her.
Oh, I agree.
Yes. Well, thanks, Carolyn.
My pleasure once again.
Yes, yes.
My conversation recorded with Carolyn Burke, author of Lee Miller, A Life. We met down at the Palace of the Legion of Honor in San Francisco at the exhibition Man Ray, Lee Miller, Partners in Surrealism. You can visit Carolyn online at carolynburke.com. I'm Suzanne Lang, and you're listening to A Novel Idea. It's KRCB Public Media for the North Bay. Download our podcast from iTunes. We'll go out with another strong, unique artist, Bjork. Thanks for listening.
Heaven, heaven spot this world around me, make me wonder. And they say back then our universe was an empty sea until a silver fox and her cunning mate began to sing a song that became the world we know. Heaven, heaven's bodies whirl around me, make me wonder. And they say back then our universe was a cold black egg until the God inside burst out and from its shattered shell he made what became the world we know. Carved it up.